From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. And coming up in the program, local scientists find a way to early detect oral cancer. Oral cancer affects tens of thousands of Americans each year, but it's a less well-publicized cancer than some others, and there's less screening for it. Also, the story of a Carmichael girl who died of meningitis just hours after symptoms appeared. There's a campaign to get more young people to be vaccinated against this potentially deadly disease. And recycling, should you use blue bags or not? But first, the on-again, off-again story of same-sex marriages in California took another turn yesterday, just as many same-sex couples in the state were planning to get married this week as the stay was scheduled to expire tomorrow afternoon. A federal appeals court has extended the ban while it considers the Proposition 8 case. Joining us with analysis and perspective on this is Lawrence Levine, who's a professor of law at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law. His specialties include legal issues involving sexual orientation. Larry, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me again.
Did you expect the appeals court, and specifically we're talking about a three-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, did you expect them to extend the stay on same-sex marriages while they consider the case?
I wasn't surprised by the decision at all. I think it could have gone either way, but I think they were being cautious and concerned about the possibility that a ruling that disagreed with the Judge Walker's ruling could cause us to nullify marriages. And so I think this was sort of the safer, more cautious route.
Do you think it was a prudent action by the appeals court? You said they could have gone either way. Do you think it makes sense for them to have been prudent?
Yeah, I think it was the more cautious, and it was like you suggested. It's not really a great surprise to me because I think they really need to decide this case on its merits.
But I hear that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sometimes takes a long time to consider cases, but it appears that they're going to expedite this one. They're going to consider it in just a matter of months. Again, are you surprised that they're speeding up the timetable for this case?
I thought that was telling. I think it was an indication that they are aware that those who are being denied the right to marry are being injured and that they need to deal with this issue quickly.
My guest is Larry Levine. He's professor of law at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. We're talking about the latest events in the Proposition 8 case, which has been extending for a couple of years now and will apparently continue for quite some time to come. Let's say the appeals court had not extended the stay and they allowed same-sex marriages to resume in California. Could opponents of same-sex marriage have then sort of leapfrogged that and asked the U.S. Supreme Court to extend the stay while the appeals court considered the issue?
In fact, I would have assumed that that's what they would have done. And in this case already, the Supreme Court has had occasion to chime in. There was an issue about whether their public was going to have access through the internet to the proceedings while they were going on during the trial. And the Supreme Court of the United States ordered Judge Walker not to allow broad public access in a unusual, which would have been an unusual thing to do. So it would be absolutely possible that the Supreme Court would have chimed in on this issue had the Ninth Circuit not issued the stay.
So three judges are going to consider the issue, and they're going to do it within a few months. December, I believe, is when they're going to start actively considering the issue. What do you think? How do you think they are going to approach this legally? How much are they going to pay attention to what Judge Walker found, and how much are they going to do their own research and investigation?
That's an excellent question, and what's going to happen, I assume, is that Judge Walker's record is going to be looked at carefully. It's a very detailed and very precise record based on witness testimony, and judges will give some degree of deference to it, but they are not bound by it and are entitled to make their own decision based on the interpretation of the Constitution that they undertake.
You recently co-wrote an opinion piece that was published in the Sacramento Bee and perhaps elsewhere, and you and your colleague Courtney Joslin at UC Davis School of Law made the case that Judge Walker's ruling was a powerful one, and the headline suggested that his ruling was inevitable based on what transpired in the case. Could you summarize that case, please?
Happily, what set this case apart, we've had all across the country a variety of decisions about whether gays and lesbians can marry, typically under state constitutions. So number one, that this is different because it's really looking at the United States Constitution, thus it's potentially much more far-reaching. But second, what made this case unique was that Judge Walker here required the parties to put on witnesses. In the other cases, the parties would come in and they would say, okay, here's why society will be hurt by same-sex marriage. And here's the harm to gays and lesbians from denying them the right to marry. And some courts would say, you know, you're right. We under our state constitution, gays and lesbians have the right to marry. And some states said, under our state constitution, they don't. Here, there were witnesses testifying, and Judge Walker said to the proponents of Prop 8, you keep talking about all this great social harm that will come about by letting gays and lesbians have access to the institution of marriage. All right, prove it. Just don't say it. Put on proof that there will be harm. And they came up short in their effort to do so. And so Judge Walker's ultimate decision, to me, seemed ordained by the lack of evidence that was put on by the Proposition 8 proponents in the case before him.
My guest is Lawrence Levine, professor of law at University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law. We're talking about Proposition 8 and the latest legal events in that matter. In that opinion piece that I referred to, you and your colleague wrote, after reading Walker's blistering critique of the case presented by those defending Proposition 8, one might wonder if the loss was the result of poor lawyering. They only put up two witnesses, and one of them, as I understand, gave ambiguous testimony in support of the supporters of Proposition 8. In a criminal case, if you lose in court and the defendant feels that they did not get adequate legal representation, they can appeal on that basis. Is there any room for that in a case like this?
There really isn't. I mean, there is something called legal malpractice, but in no way do I suggest, or others to my knowledge suggest, that the lawyers really bungled the case that they were trying to make. Instead, what I think happened is they had a very hard time getting people to testify that who weren't sort of fringe or would be perceived as extreme to put on concrete evidence about social harm. So, for example, we talk a lot and we hear a lot, and the campaign in favor of Prop 8 spoke a lot about families and children. And so Judge Walker said, okay, well, explain, what's the harm to children? And the harm, it came out that the harm actually was greater by not letting the children of gay and lesbian couples have their parents' relationship being given the dignity that marriage instills.
I read in a news story that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals instructed yesterday the opponents of same-sex marriage to explain why they have legal standing in the case. What does that mean?
This is a very complicated issue, and the question that the first question, and Judge Walker in his ruling regarding the stay suggested that he really questions whether the proponents of Prop 8 do have standing. The question is, can they bring the appeal? Do they have an injury that they've suffered that gives them the right to bring an appeal based on an initiative? And it's a bit maybe ironic that on the Supreme Court of the United States, the conservative justices have given a very narrow interpretation of who has standing to bring these kinds of challenges. And so based on that, there's a credible argument that the Proposition 8 proponents really can't show that they're suffering any injuries. They don't want to, they're not being denied the right to marry, and therefore that they don't have the right to bring the claim. Who would have to bring it would be the state of California, and the governor and the attorney general have made it clear that they have no interest or intention of appealing Judge Walker's ruling. They agree with it.
And supporters of Proposition 8 are trying to put pressure on Governor Schwarzenegger and Attorney General Brown to support Proposition 8 in case. And that leads me to my next question. What is the responsibility of the governor and the attorney general in cases like this? The California Constitution says that the governor shall see that the law is faithfully executed. And as regards the attorney general, it shall be the duty of the attorney general to see that the laws of the state are uniformly and adequately enforced. Well, if Proposition 8 is currently the law, aren't they required to defend it in court, whatever they personally think of it?
That's an interesting point. I think what they would say is Proposition 8 isn't the law in the sense that we agree with the, or they agree with the constitutional analysis of Judge Walker, and if it's unconstitutional, then it's not the law, and then we go back to the law before Proposition 8, which is that gay and lesbian couples can marry. I mean, it's somewhat interesting because if you go back a bit, the governor on two occasions vetoed bills that would have permitted gays and lesbians to marry in California that had been passed by the legislature. And so it's sort of interesting now that he finds himself in this position as say when he could have signed, just made this the law of the state of California, lets it go through the courts, and now is saying, okay, the court has ruled, and I agree with the decision of Judge Walker.
And I should note that supporters of same-sex marriage are praising the governor and the attorney general for their stance in this matter. But isn't this a case of be careful what you wish for? Because couldn't it just as easily go the other way around, that there could be a law in favor of same-sex marriage, but the governor and the attorney general are personally opposed, and therefore they oppose same-sex marriage just because they have decided personally that they don't think it should be the law?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I personally think that there's a strong argument that in light of the fact that the proponents of Prop 8 were allowed to intervene, they were given permission to serve as what were called interveners and really put on the trial before Judge Walker, that gives them the right to bring this appeal. Because I think if we define standing too narrowly, you're exactly right that there'll be other situations where when the shoe's on the proverbial other foot, it's going to potentially create injustice. And so I ultimately expect that the court is going to allow the Prop 8 proponents to pursue this appeal and decide, and then they would have to decide this case on its merits. The Ninth Circuit would have to decide the case on its merits.
And finally, Larry, what do you think is going to happen when the matter is actually considered by the Court of Appeals?
That's almost an impossible question to answer. But I will say that the first thing that will be very interesting to see is who is the panel. The way this works, there are over a score of judges on the Ninth Circuit, and randomly three judges will be selected to hear this case. And as you said, they'll be hearing it in December. One thing that will be interesting to see is who those three judges are. And even then, even after they rule, which I expect will be sometime, maybe spring of next year, the losing party has the right to go back to the Ninth Circuit and ask for what's called an en banc hearing to have more judges hear it. So we still have a long process ahead. And I will only say that Judge Walker has given a very powerful record, and so it'll depend on how much deference the judges choose to give to the record he created. But this is all going to be a long process.
And with a lot of moving parts.
Indeed. And a full employment act for lawyers.
Larry Levine at Pacific McGeorge School of Law, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, meningitis. It's a potentially fatal disease that's a particular concern to young people. There's a campaign underway right now to encourage young people to get vaccinated against it. You'll hear, among other things, the sad story of a Carmichael girl who died just hours after she was after her symptoms of meningitis appeared. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email your topic suggestions to insight@capradio.org. Coming up today on Talk of the Nation, mosques in American neighborhoods. Also, writer Tom Bissell was addicted to video games like Grand Theft Auto, but amid the excess, he found value. And it's the subject of his new book, Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. That's Talk of the Nation at 11. Now on Insight, meningitis. It's a serious, potentially fatal disease that can affect all kinds of people, but it's of particular concern to younger people for a couple of reasons. This week is Voices of Meningitis Week, both in Sacramento County and elsewhere. It's a campaign to try and encourage young people to get vaccinated against meningitis. In a couple of minutes' time, you'll hear from Dr. Glenna Trochet, Sacramento County's public health officer. But first, I spoke with Rose Quett, whose 15-year-old daughter Mary Jo died of meningitis just hours after symptoms appeared. And I started by asking Rose to tell us what happened to her daughter.
Well, one Saturday morning, Mary Jo wasn't feeling well. She complained of a sore throat. And I'm a registered nurse, so I checked her throat, did not see anything unusual, no redness, no swelling, no blotches, but she did feel warm to me. But I had to go to work, so I left her, and I told her that I'm going to check on her throughout the day, but to call me if she felt worse. So that afternoon, Mary Jo called, and she said that she had brown spots on her face. So I immediately went home. On my way home, I was thinking, she hasn't been feeling well. Now she has brown spots. And I said, oh, my goodness, she has meningitis. And when I got home, I found Mary Jo sitting on the couch, still awake, alert, talking. But the brown spots had changed into blotchy purple rash. So I called 911, and she was rushed to the hospital. And then she threw up around 5:30 in the afternoon, and her heart stopped. And so she tried to save her, but she didn't make it. She was pronounced dead at 6 p.m. that night. So Mary Jo died within 13 hours after her first symptoms. And that's why I started an organization after Mary Jo, Meningitis Awareness Key to Prevention. And I go to schools to present to students about meningitis, tell them about meningitis, and also tell them about the vaccine.
Now, you're a nurse, Rose.
I am.
How familiar were you with meningitis, and did it occur to you right at the start that maybe that's what Mary Jo had?
Not in the morning, because she just complained of that sore throat, and so, plus she just felt warm. And my kids, I have two kids, boy and girl, and they had complained of sore throats before, and they had the flu. So the symptoms were just like the flu. And so at that time, I did not think about meningitis. But on my way home, like I said, I knew she had meningitis at that time.
Had Mary Jo been vaccinated?
No, because at that time, the guidelines were different from the new guidelines, the current guidelines. She died in 2000, July 2000. She was only 15 years old, 8 days before her 16th birthday. And the vaccine wasn't recommended for that age. And also, she went to Mexico on a school mission to work with physically and mentally handicapped children. And when I went to the doctor 2 weeks before she went to Mexico, He did not recommend the vaccination. And so when Mary Jo died and I called him again and I said, how come you did not tell me about the vaccine? And he said, well, she was too young and it wasn't recommended for her travel to a Spanish-speaking country.
Also with us is Dr. Glenna Trochet, Sacramento County Public Health Officer. Dr. Trochet, welcome back to Inside.
Well, thank you for having me.
This terrible story we just heard here about Mary Jo, she died about half a day after her symptoms became obvious. Is that common with meningitis for it to proceed that quickly?
Yes, unfortunately it is common. And in fact, that year and the next year, we had deaths of several young people in this community from this disease. And Mrs. Quett is correct. Back then, there was a vaccine. It was a polysaccharide vaccine that was available, and it was not recommended at that time for young people.
How do you get meningitis?
Well, this is a bacteria that can live in the nose and throat of healthy people. And many people carry it for a while and don't even know it and don't get sick. For reasons that we don't understand, in some people, it becomes this overwhelming infection that is very hard to recognize at first because it does look very much like the flu. But then it progresses very quickly, as you have heard from Mrs. Quett, and can cause death. And even people who survive may end up with disabilities such as loss of hearing or an amputation of an arm or a leg. It's really a very serious disease.
What exactly does it do to you?
The bacteria can enter the bloodstream and cause a septicemia, an infection of the bloodstream, or it can cause meningitis, which is a swelling of the lining of the brain. When people get meningitis, if they are not treated quickly enough, they can develop a coma and death.
How do you know you have meningitis? You said that at the start you can just think you have the flu, but what are the telltale signs once it should become obvious that it's not just the flu?
People who have meningitis develop a difficulty with, well, a terrible headache, a really severe headache, high fever, bright lights really bother them. They might have some neck rigidity, and that bending the neck really hurts them. They just feel terrible. They cannot function. There are lots of other causes of meningitis besides meningococcal disease. But with meningococcal disease, they can also develop this rash, just as Mrs. Quett also described. It's a reddish or purplish rash. It can occur anywhere on the body. And when you see that, that's a real danger sign. You should seek medical treatment right away.
Dr. Glenna Trochet, Sacramento County Public Health Officer, we're talking about meningitis. Why is it that younger people, especially teens and young adults, seem to be especially at risk?
Well, that is more the epidemiology of the disease. It seems to really affect very young children under the age of 2, and unfortunately there is no vaccine at this point for children that age, or young people who are in close contact with each other. So the folks that are at the highest risk are actually freshmen in college who live in dormitories. This disease can also affect recruits that are in the army living in barracks. It is spread person to person, usually from the infected person through droplets or, as I said, from a healthy carrier to somebody who is susceptible to the disease. It is important, in addition to vaccine, to not share personal items, such as lipsticks or drinking from the same water bottle, those sorts of things.
But, of course, young people often do those kinds of things. They share personal items. They're either at summer camp, they're in dormitories, they're in barracks, whatever. Their lives bring them in close contact with each other. I don't suppose it's possible to completely change your lifestyle so that you could never be exposed to it. What else can people do to prevent themselves from getting meningitis?
Well, now there's this very effective vaccine. It's a newer vaccine. It's a conjugate vaccine, and we would recommend that particularly young people between the ages of 11 and 21 get vaccinated. They are at 5 times at higher risk than adults for getting meningitis, and this vaccine can help prevent it.
Now, you know, of course, that there are a lot of people in our society who are worried about vaccination for a variety of reasons. Is there any reason to be concerned about this particular vaccine?
Well, there, and I'll let Mrs. Quay also talk about this, but, you know, there's no medical intervention that's 100% safe. Every vaccine may have some side effects. Usually the side effects are not serious. Usually they are maybe some soreness in the area where the injection was given, sometimes some redness. Sometimes people might feel a little feverish for a day or two. Occasionally there are serious side effects. This vaccine has been shown to be just as safe as any of the other vaccines, and there have been very few reports of adverse effects.
Rose,
I just want to mention that my son is vaccinated about 4 years ago.
Yes.
With the new vaccine.
Rose, do you have reason to believe that if Mary Jo had been vaccinated, she would not have caught meningitis?
Oh, definitely. I believe Mary Jo would still be here with us today if she had been vaccinated. And if the doctor would have mentioned at that time that she could have gotten the vaccine, I would have given it to her.
Okay. Well, that's Rose Quett. Her 15-year-old daughter, Mary Jo, died of meningitis just 13 hours after symptoms appeared. Also with us, Dr. Glenna Trochet, Sacramento County Public Health Officer. Sacramento County Board of Supervisors has declared this week Voices of Meningitis Week in support of a national campaign in support of vaccinations against meningitis. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, more health news. Local scientists have come up with a new way for early detection of oral cancer. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can also keep up with us on Facebook. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. On tomorrow's Insight, you'll hear food author Joanne Neft and her book of recipes for each week of the year using Placer County food. Also, weekly comedy night at Luna's Cafe celebrates its first birthday. Tens of thousands of Americans get oral cancer each year, but it's not a highly publicized cancer, and there isn't as much screening for it as with several other cancers. Think of breast cancer, prostate, skin, lung. Scientists at UC Davis have come up with a laser probe for the early detection of oral cancer, and it seems the probe might also be useful during surgery. We're going to start a conversation with Laura Marcoux, who is professor of biomedical engineering and neurological surgery at UC Davis. Laura, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
How do patients and doctors currently detect oral cancer?
So this is probably what the surgeon or doctor will better answer.
Our other guest, Dr. Farwell.
Yes.
If you prefer, I go
to
him.
So basically they have either certain test biopsies that will detect if a particular tissue is disease or normal, or what kind of disease, or if it's inflammation, or is a tumor in that particular area which is suspect to be a cancerous area.
Well, the surgeon Laura Marcoux referred to is Dr. Gregory Farwell. Dr. Farwell, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Could you talk a bit more about how you currently detect oral cancer and how useful those techniques are?
Well, the current techniques are very useful and have been used for many generations. They rely on a surgeon or a physician's ability to see an abnormal area, and then a sample of that tissue is removed and analyzed under the microscope by a pathologist to look for abnormality within that tissue consistent with a tumor.
So, given the current state of science and setting aside this probe that we're talking about, was there a need for something better, something more reliable, something that could detect oral cancer earlier?
Well, we've not had a tremendous success in improving outcomes of this disease for many years. So I would argue that it's definitely an area where any improvement could be very useful for our patients.
Yes.
As The mouth is sometimes a difficult area to evaluate, and sometimes these lesions can be quite subtle.
Laura Marcoux, could you tell us simply, because it's a very complicated process, but simply how this probe works that can help detect oral cancer earlier?
So first, I would like to refer to the principle behind the measurement. Basically, certain molecules in tissue have the property of absorbing a particular color or wavelength of light. And as a result, they become excited, and they will stay excited for a very short time. After that, they will relax and will emit, in turn, of a particular color or a range of colors. And this acts as a fingerprint on identifying the molecule.
Because the tumor gives off a certain color, and that is an indicator that it's a tumor as opposed to something else.
Correct. So the tumor biomolecular makeup will be different than a normal tissue. And as a result, using this fluorescence signature, so this process of emitting light is called fluorescence. And will be very specific, will act as a fingerprint of the molecules, or if either the tissue is normal or diseased.
Now, what does it involve if you were a patient and you were to use this device on me? How long would it take? Is it some big machine? Is it painful?
It's absolutely, it's not painful. It's just shine light into the tissue and you collect the ray-emitted light by the same tissue and analyze the characteristic of the ray-emitted light in order to identify whether you have a tumor or that is a normal tissue. So it's basically no pain involved. Again, it's like shining a flashlight on your skin.
Except it happens to be a laser.
We're
talking about a new way for early detection of oral cancer, devised at UC Davis, and our studio, Laura Marcoux, Professor of Biomedical Engineering and Neurological Surgery. Dr. Farwell, you, of course, have worked closely with Laura Marcoux on this, and I assume you've tried out this probe on patients. How well does it work?
Well, I've had the privilege of working with Dr. Marcoux for several years, and we've brought this technology into our operating room and have participated through clinical trials on patients who have a diagnosis of cancer. And we are very happy with our preliminary results with this technology. It appears to offer a significant advantage, and it's our hope that as we continue to refine it, that advantage will become more and more.
Remind us of the of what oral cancer involves. How often is it fatal? How does it affect people?
Well, this is one of those cancers where there is a dramatic difference between catching it early and catching it too late. The vast majority of patients present where the tumor has already spread, and the prognosis is very much linked to the stage at diagnosis. So if we can diagnose these tumors earlier, we have a much better chance of getting that patient through their treatment and curing them of their disease.
What are the risk factors for oral cancer?
Well, historically, the biggest two risk factors have been tobacco abuse and excessive use of alcohol. More recently, we've also noted that human papillomavirus is becoming a bigger risk factor.
People often refer to it as HPV.
That's correct, uh-huh.
Now, when you talked about the difference between, for the patient, between finding oral cancer early and late, well, when a tumor is removed from most parts of the body, it could be unsightly, but you know, you get away with it because clothing covers it. But if you have oral cancer and there's a big portion of your face or neck removed, then that has other issues. Part of your work is reconstructive surgery. Is that a common issue for people who have oral cancer?
It is a very common issue, and it's only one of the challenges with this particular disease. The face is right there, and so people are always dealing with the cosmetic and aesthetic deficits that these tumors sometimes require. Probably an even more important and underappreciated problem are the functional problems. If I have to remove a portion of someone's tongue, they may not be able to swallow, or if I have to remove a portion of their throat, they may not be able to speak as well. And those are quite troubling to our patients.
Laura Marcoux, I read that this probe is similar to one or works in a similar way to a probe that you developed for use with brain tumors. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Does that mean that this could work with other tumors? I mean, if it works with brain tumors and oral cancer, why not any other part of the body?
Yes, it can work with any type of tumor, but not only tumors. It can be used in cardiovascular applications, more recently on tissue engineering area. So any tissue can be characterized using this technique.
And are there any reasons why you focus so far on brain tumors and oral cancer?
I had the opportunity to work with great surgeons, and that gave me the opportunity to advance this technology, to test them in the clinical settings. But provided that I can interface with different surgical environments and also different areas of medicine that requires the use of non-invasive or minimally invasive diagnosis, then I can actually use this technique in many, many areas of medicine.
And along with screening for oral cancer, the probe can also be used or could also be used to help surgeons while they're operating on a tumor. Is that right? And how does it work?
This is correct. Basically, one advantage of the technology that we develop is not that we are using only the fluorescence emission or spectrum of the fluorescence emission to characterize the tumor, but also some of these molecules in tissue that fluoresce, some of them will fluoresce much quickly than the other. And being able to analyze the time difference between different ways of emitting this light, we're able actually to more precisely identify the origin of fluorescence. And as a result, we can better distinguish using this technique between disease and normal. And this is important during surgery because the fluorescence intensity or spectrum can be affected by blood, which is in surgical field, but will not affect the time of relaxation or this time difference between different molecules. So we can use that information in order to better diagnose in blood environment if we are in an area of normal or disease.
Yes. Gregory Farwell, you've presumably used this in a surgical setting. Is it hard to see the tumor when you're operating on it, and therefore do you need a device like this to help compensate for what you can't properly see with your eyes?
I think this offers a tremendous potential. The tumors sometimes are quite subtle. And as I was mentioning, I joke with my colleagues that they could remove an extra foot of a colon and the patient would never notice a difference. But removing an extra centimeter of the tongue can be the difference between never being able to eat. So we're always trying to make sure we remove the tumor but leave as much of that patient's normal tissue in place as possible. And this is a probe that offers the potential to help us decrease the amount of normal tissue we remove and at the same time make sure we get every bit of that cancer out.
That's Gregory Farwell. He's a head and neck surgeon and associate professor at the Department of Otolaryngology at UC Davis, specifically at the Cancer Center there. And in our studio, Laura Marcoux, professor of biomedical engineering and neurological surgery at UC Davis. She and others at UC Davis have created a laser probe for the early detection of oral cancer. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, recycling. Do you need to use blue bags or not? listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more about the people and topics in our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Recently, while up in the Tahoe area, I was looking through a monthly paper called Moonshine Inc., and I saw an ad that really caught my attention. It was an ad from the town of Truckee, and it had the intriguing title, Truckee's Urban Myths Debunked. And urban myth number one was, workers sort the trash, so there's no need to use a blue bag. And then it says, the fact of the matter is, it's true that workers sort through trash in search of discarded recyclables. However, the recovery rate is only between 17 and 19%. Recyclables placed in blue bags are recovered nearly 100% of the time. End of quote. Well, I don't know about you, but in my recycling information, it says no need to use a blue bag because all the recyclables can easily be plucked out of the garbage can by workers. So what's really going on here? Let's start our conversation with Nicole Dorr, who's recycling coordinator for the town of Truckee. Nicole, welcome to Insight.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, why is it that in Truckee, people should use a blue bag as opposed to other places where they say, forget about the blue bag?
Well, we encourage our residents and visitors to use the blue bags because we do feel that by using blue bags, there is an increased recovery rate once the material arrives at the transfer station. We do, of course, have workers working and sorting the trash. Folks from Tahoe Truckee see our disposal. And although they do a really good job, we feel that if folks use blue bags and use a strong, durable blue bag, which withstands the collection process, that the recovery rate of those recyclables is, in fact, increased.
Yeah, and mentioning the blue bag there, urban myth number two in Truckee was that it's okay to use any bag that's blue, and this ad says, no, you need to use a special, sturdy blue bag. Why did you need to put out this ad? Are a lot of people in Truckee putting the recyclables into the trash can without putting it first into a blue bag?
Well, actually, we have a really high rate of participation in the blue bag program. In 2009 alone, there was about 264,000 blue bags put out on the curb by residents and visitors. One of the things that we are trying to educate folks about is there's been a long-time standing myth that folks don't need to use that blue bag because folks do sort the recycling. And although that's true, again, we're looking to get a higher rate of recovery. Because our blue bags are picked up on a single truck, on a single route, that means the blue bags are picked up with the garbage. A strong, durable blue bag is what folks need to utilize. Many of our retailers are providing bags, but they're very thin, and then residents at home stuff it with heavy glass and lots of newspaper, and those bags are ripping before they're even put in a truck. And then the materials mix back in with the waste stream. Mm-hmm. So one of our goals at this point is to educate folks on the process happening with those blue bags and how they're collected, and then the need to purchase the strongest blue bags available. We have done some work with some retailers to accomplish that, and now we're just trying to get folks out there to think about the fact that their blue bags are taking a ride on the garbage truck, and therefore a strong blue bag does make a difference in getting those materials recovered, yeah.
But you know, of course, that many places say you don't need a blue bag anymore. Have you studied how it goes in those communities and concluded that, no, the Truckee way is the better way?
Yeah, well, we've looked at it. In fact, the town of Truckee is currently in the process of hiring some consultants to do a further evaluation of the effectiveness of the blue bags and its associated costs. You know, our program up here, as far as the transfer station is concerned, is about 15 people standing on a conveyor belt picking up or picking through the trash and the recycling. We are a little prohibited of doing a kind of more standard collection of the recyclables, meaning like in Sacramento you have one container for trash and another container for recyclables and another container for green waste collection. Up here, due to the fact that we have bears and quite a few second homeowners, we have bear boxes, which really challenges us in putting second routes on the road. It's been more efficient to utilize blue bags so everything could be picked up together. And since the blue bag program was started back in 2000 or so, we have since implemented a green bag program to collect the green waste material. So it is a little different up here. We're dealing with some different logistical challenges, including those second homes
and the bears.
Yeah.
Nicole Dorr, recycling coordinator for the town of Truckee. Also with us is Walt Schwall, who's senior civil engineer at Placer County Facility Services. He oversees closed landfill compliance monitoring and maintenance. Walt, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Well, why is it that in South Placer County, you don't need a blue bag, and they say, forget about it, whereas up in Truckee, you do need a blue bag? Why is it different in, say, South Placer County as opposed to up in Truckee?
Well, in south and western part of Placer County, we have a more automated system, although we do have similar operations with the material recovery facilities, both at Western and in Eastern Regional at the Truckee facility. 45% or so of the waste comes from unincorporated Placer County. Another 45% comes from the town of Truckee, and it's all sorted at the same facility. There are blue bags that come in. They come in on the same trucks, and they're sorted through the same process. The blue bags are separated out initially at the beginning of the operation, with the rest of the waste is processed through and recyclables are removed. And then typically at the end of the day, the operator, the last hour or so, will process the blue bags separately. But it goes through the same process. And I'm not sure about the 17 or 18%, but typically the MRF operation itself, not counting concrete and other types of recyclables, runs about 35% recovery.
Well, there's a bit of a difference here in statistics, but setting that aside, because I have a hunch we won't resolve that right now, doesn't it make sense that if people put their recyclables into a sturdy blue bag, that you're going to recover more of that than if people just toss their newspapers and all sorts of stuff into one big bin?
Well, we recover from everything. We process everything through the same process. The blue bags have to be separated out, and then when they're processed, they have to be torn back open and spread out on the line to be recycled. And they have to be, typically they run a lot slower, so it takes longer to run through the blue bags. They have to slow down the belts to pull the materials out.
So as far as you're concerned, the recycling recovery rate is perfectly good without the blue bags, and it might even be more efficient. Is that what you're saying?
I think we're doing a good job. I think we could do better. I don't have any statistics to say whether or not the blue bags are improve the operation or hinder it. At our Western facility, it's much more automated system. It is a little more difficult to process the blue bags. It interferes with the automation. At our Eastern facility in Truckee, it is less automated. It's more a lot of hand sorting, so it is less of an impact. But there is a little more time involved in sorting the blue bags.
But with newspapers, don't they get totally trashed when they get mixed in with coffee filters and all sorts of other wet trash?
They can. But working in the landfill, I found that you can dig up old landfill and find newspapers in perfectly good shape after 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. Nicole Dorr, these blue bags that are important to use in Truckee, do you give them away for free or do people have to buy them?
A little bit of both. We encourage folks to purchase their own blue bags, and we recommend some various retailers here in town. We also provide blue bags for free on occasion. We're downtown at our Truckee Thursdays events, handing those bags out, and at various other public education and outreach opportunities. Folks can always come by the town hall and pick up a few to get their program started. But we do encourage, for the long-term sustainability of the program, for folks to purchase their blue bags at area retailers.
And finally, Walt Schwall, what is the norm in bigger urban areas? Is it the norm now to not use blue bags?
I couldn't tell you. I know it varies from city to county. Some have a lot of jurisdictions go to source-separated recycling, where they have a separate bin itself, a separate green waste bin, and then a separate waste bin. Others are getting into what they call the dirty sort, the dirty MRF, where everything just goes into the one big bin.
Well, we've been talking about recycling. Do you need to use blue bags or not, and which is better? Nicole Dorr, recycling coordinator for the town of Truckee, which does require or strongly urge the use of blue bags, and Walt Schwall, senior civil engineer at Placer County Facility Services. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
And that's Insight for today. Today's associate producers, Natalie Rothfels, Lynn Weaver, and Maripon Say. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.